This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhibi in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Well, I wish to call on Tinubu to hit the ground running by tackling some of the challenges facing Nigeria. Challenges such as in the areas of poverty alleviation, insecurity, quality health care.
And that was a voter in Nigeria on his hopes for the country's new president. Details coming up. Also, Namibia is on the alert after a Crimean Congo fever death, and U.S. lawmakers race to avoid a debt crisis. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight.
We shall defend the nation from terror and all forms of criminality that threaten the peace, and stability of our country. We shall remodel our economy to bring our growth and develop the GDP.
That was the new president, Asiwaju Bola Tinubu, speaking just after he took the oath of office as Nigeria's new president. The president of Africa's largest democracy has now taken the reins of power, and many challenges lie ahead. Sandy Bitrus is a Nigeria analyst and a national president of Zumunta, an association of Nigerians in the United States working to contribute to the development of their homeland. He says former President Muhammadu Buhari's 2 4-year terms have left many Nigerians disappointed. One of the endemic issues the new president should tackle and address, besides the country's security, Bitrus says, is a framework which to tackle the issue of corruption.
Muhammad Buhari, on his arrival, he arrived with a lot of promise and a lot of hope. A lot of Nigerians were despondent and hope were projected through his candidacy. And over these several years, I would say that based on our general observation and conversation with a lot of people back in Nigeria, they have indicated, and we know, that some of those hopes and aspirations were never fulfilled. However, we expected a whole lot more, but it was never attained. And those are some of the concerns that people had with the legacy of President Muhammadu Buhari over the last 8 years.
How about Mr. Buhari utilizing Chinese loans, for instance, to upgrade the ailing road and rail infrastructure, building a new port in Lagos?
I would say yes, those will be part of his achievement. But to a large extent, I think it's some of the concerns that a lot of the regular masses are having to complain about is the drop in the standard of living. It is becoming extremely difficult for people to both improve their lives and obtain certain basic amenities that you would normally expect in a country that we would say has the potential to achieve and better the livelihoods of people. In terms of the general infrastructure, yes, those are we expect that to be a regular part of governance, and I do not think that to a large extent those cannot be undermined. Those are certainly achievements that we would accord to the Buhari administration. Yes.
Moving forward now, Tinubu now trained as an accountant in the United States and worked for several U.S. companies, including as a treasurer for oil giant ExxonMobil. What should his priorities be moving forward?
Well, I think the priorities has always been the same over the last several years of civilian administration in Nigeria. I think we've had to deal with a lot of issues, which includes but not limited to the fact that there should be, for example, press freedom, increase in press freedom. And I think that they often, the refrain we always speak about in terms of one of the core areas is in the area of security, right? And there should be integration of the people from all across the country. But in terms of providing services and supporting the administration in trying to achieve what they need to achieve, we know that Tinubu has he has a track record of working with people across board, and those are some of the fundamental areas we expect that he is going to put in place. He has to hit the ground running. The country cannot wait for several months before they appoint those who should be supporting his government in achieving their set objectives. I think those are the fundamentals in terms of what we're looking for. But again, we know that some of these priorities change from day to day, so we are looking forward to at least setting those baselines in place.
And there are these lingering questions about his health and past corruption allegations.
Yeah, I mean, there is a reputation that he comes with, and if that is a reputation that people are holding of him, we are looking to, they should make all the necessary effort to dispel those concerns, because those could potentially weigh heavily in terms of both credibility and in terms of the legitimacy, in terms of leadership role and leadership responsibility. And if he has been assigned, or he has been assigned as the president or voted as the president, then he has that legitimacy in that respect. But both in terms of reputation that he will have in governance, those are certainly areas that need to be addressed as quickly as possible so people can have the confidence and the stability that they need in terms of saying, knowing that they have a president that has the capability of ruling with clean hands.
Today, a new president takes the helm in Nigeria. Anything you'd like to add?
Yes, for a new president that comes into Nigeria, I think one of the endemic issues that needs to be addressed beyond the security thing is to begin to look at the idea of creating a framework that can handle and manage the issue of corruption. Corruption is a fundamental issue that is affecting the reputation of Nigeria, both in terms of the day-to-day business of people in the country and foreign direct investors who are looking to invest in the country. They need to have a framework, and some of those frameworks are available for use for the country to minimize the effects of corruption on the country. But where there is no political will to be able to address corruption as a key area that's affecting Nigeria, that becomes a concern.
That is Sunday Bitrus, a Nigerian analyst and the national president of Zumunta. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of Virginia. Reporter Mike Mbonye spoke with several voters in Port Harcourt to hear what they hope the new president and his cabinet will focus on.
My name is Augustine Okoli. I'm a civil servant. The first agenda I'm setting for them is to see how they will work on the economy. That is very, very important. Then the unity of the country is paramount. We are heavily divided as a people. So what I expect the incoming administration to do is that they have to work on the economy to make sure that our economy comes back to what it used to be. Then we as a people have to be united. And I think it's incumbent on the incoming administration to see that these things are achieved.
My name is Steve Daniels. I am a pharmacist. Well, I wish to call on Tinubu to hit the ground running by tackling some of the challenges facing Nigeria, challenges such as in the areas of poverty alleviation, insecurity, quality health care, and also improvement in infrastructures, and also to ensure that all our refineries are repaired and made functional.
My name is Mr. Augustine Nwachukwu, a retired civil servant. My expectation will be for them to unite the country, because the present government has brought some things that have disunited the nation, and I expect them to do more by reducing insecurity in the country, bringing down the inflation in the country, because the cost of living now in Nigeria is very high, and so many other things that we are expecting them that we turn the country around for good.
Those were voters in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye about their hopes for President Bola Tinubu's administration. A man recently died in Namibia of Crimean-Congo hemorrhagic fever, known as Congo fever, a viral disease transmitted by ticks. Namibia's Ministry of Health says the case was confirmed on Sunday after testing. The man who died last week was in isolation in the capital, Windhoek. Health workers have been in contact with a total of 27 people who might have been exposed to him. VOA's Carol Van Dam spoke with Dr. Amash Adalaja, an infectious disease physician at Johns Hopkins Hospital near Washington, D.C., and a senior scholar with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, about the virus.
It's in the tick population. It's in the wildlife population. So I don't necessarily think one would be considered an outbreak. They do get sporadic cases that occur. If there is transmission onward from people that may have come into contact with his blood or body fluids, or if there's more cases occurring because maybe changes in behavior, the tick, or with interactions with certain animals, then I think it would be called an outbreak. I don't necessarily think I would call it an outbreak at this point, but I think it's something where they need to look at the contacts of that patient to make sure that there's no onward transmission and to be aggressive with understanding how this person got infected.
How does this hemorrhagic fever case compare with other hemorrhagic fever outbreaks in Africa?
Well, what's unique about Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever is that it's spread primarily by ticks, whereas other hemorrhagic fevers like Ebola or Marburg are transmitted not through ticks, but through exposure to blood and body fluids. So in that sense, it's very different. This is something that people get infected with in a very different manner. And one of the other unique things about it was, you know, you called it Congo fever, but its actual full name is Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever because it was first described in the Crimea and in former Soviet Union in the 1950s. So this also has a wider geographic endemicity than other hemorrhagic fevers, meaning that it's in the Crimea as well as in parts of Africa. There are no vaccines for it. There are some experimental antivirals that people use.
You talked about how it's spread by ticks and, you know, it can come from animals. Is that why this disease is called a zoonosis, or what does that mean exactly?
Zoonosis is a term that means any kind of infectious disease that moves from an animal species into humans. So Ebola is a zoonosis as well. What's different about Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever is that it's vector-borne, meaning that the tick is the vector. So that makes it different versus other hemorrhagic fevers. But all hemorrhagic fevers are zoonosis. They all have animal hosts.
What's the mortality rate of this kind of hemorrhagic fever?
About, you know, 30 to 50% around on average.
That's kind of high. Are people on alert in Namibia and elsewhere?
Well, I think that once there's a case of people, again, this is something that's endemic or that occurs in Africa sporadically. There have been cases in Namibia in the past before. Right now, I don't think there's enough information because we have a single case. So this might be just a single case that came from a tick bite or interaction with some animal. The alert really happens as if there's onward human-to-human spread, meaning that people are getting exposed to blood and body fluids or they're in an area where these ticks are of high prevalence.
That was Dr. Amash Awalaja, an infectious disease physician at Johns Hopkins Hospital. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from the city of Baltimore in the U.S. state of Maryland. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Sudan's warring sides are under pressure today to extend a shaky ceasefire in their battle for control of the country after two key international mediators signaled impatience with persistent truce violations. Yesterday, the United States and Saudi Arabia called out Sudan's military and its rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, for breaches of a week-long truce which expires tonight. Sudan descended into chaos after fighting erupted in mid-April between the military led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and RSF commanded by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. There are estimates nearly 900 civilians have been killed and thousands wounded. The head of the United Nations Refugee Agency today warned estimates for the number of refugees Sudan may be too low. More than 350,000 people have already fled across borders, with most heading to Egypt, Chad, and South Sudan. More than 1 million have been displaced within Sudan. UNHCR's head Filippo Grandi said the agency had forecast about 1 million people would flee Sudan over 6 months. Now he says that number may be conservative. The Ugandan military says some of their soldiers were captured by Al-Shabaab militants following Friday's attack at their base in the town of Bulomarar, 110 kilometers south of Mogadishu. Uganda's People's Defense Force spokesperson, Brigadier General Felix Kulagie, spoke with VOA Somali service reporter Harun Maruf by phone today about the attack.
What we know is that the base was attacked by Al-Shabaab. We know that it appears the soldiers did not do the right response because they would have had a chance to destroy the big group of Al-Shabaab of about 800 that attacked them. The defense is well equipped. They had what it takes. So we think they were not prepared. They didn't do the right, take right decisions, and they fled the defense in the midst of the fire, out of the shock of the explosion, I think. And the rest of the details we shall get when the team gets on the ground.
And who is in control of the base at this time?
The base, our people are not yet back to the base, of course. So it is still empty.
Can you tell us exactly what led to the sudden collapse of UPDF forces at the base? Normally, we know that UPDF is very well trained and they have accustomed to fighting the insurgencies. What happened in this case? Why was it different?
That's what I am yet to know. The team we sent on the ground, which arrived there yesterday, we find out what happened. Because indeed, we are always invisible. We have never been beaten. What happened this time? It's a big question we won't find out.
So the question that everybody is asking is, tell us about the casualties. At this time, how many bodies were recovered? How many injuries? How many are missing? Al-Shabaab is claiming, as you know, that they have killed 137 soldiers. They also claim it they captured some prisoners of war. Your response?
Of course, that's not correct, because this was a company of 221. If they have killed all those and captured all those, then where did the balance come from? Like I said, those are the details I will give you once we have our investigations done. For now, I would be speculating.
Do we know how many survived it?
Again, like I said, all those details I'll give after the investigations are done.
Is Al-Shabaab way off from the truth in terms of death toll?
Yes, they are. They are, certainly the exaggerating.
What about the soldiers they claim to have captured? Do you believe some of your soldiers were captured by Al-Shabaab?
I don't just believe. I know some were.
How many do you think might have been captured?
That's speculation I can't do.
And the bigger picture, where does this leave UPDF mission within ATMIS in Somalia? Does this change the calculation, the presence of UPDF in Somalia?
That leaves UPDF more determined to fight the terrorists of Al-Shabaab. It gives us more determination to deal with this enemy of peace in Somalia.
So how are you going to respond? Is Uganda going to send more troops? Are you going to go after Al-Shabaab? What's going to happen?
They will pay for that attack. No one attacks UPDF and goes scot-free. They will pay.
That was Brigadier General Felix Kulagiye with the Ugandan People's Defense Forces. He was speaking with VOA's Harun Maruf. The Ugandan troops are in Somalia to support Mogadishu as it battles the Al-Shabaab militants. The Egyptian club Al Ahli defeated AS Douanes of Senegal 80-65 on Saturday in Kigali, Rwanda, to lift the 2023 Basketball Africa League trophy. Al Ahli's South Sudanese forward Nuni Omot tallied a game-high 22 points in the final and took home the Hakim Olajuwon Trophy as the league's most valuable player. VOA's Mokbilia Baro and Chik Tero recap the action.
On this segment of ANT today, we have our VOA colleague, Sheikh Tiero, live from Kigali, Rwanda. Thanks for being with us today, Sheikh.
Thank you, Mugdu. Nothing but net. Let's talk about it, bro.
Absolutely. The BAL just concluded this weekend with some exciting games. We will have Sheikh give us a rundown of the finals game, Al Ahli versus AS Douanes. Sheikh, talk to me about that game.
Ali came to give the first punch from the start. We saw that, and everybody was expecting to AS Douanes to do the same thing, because they struggled even to beat AS Padmalian from Mali. So people really thought AS Douanes going to take lessons from that, because if you are part of this big this team, Al Ahly, they have problems. If you start with them on defensive end and offensive end, the big men cannot move, which is a big man that AS Douanes had, and also Padmalian had. You saw how Padmalian was outrunning them on every position. So they had to calm the game and play the way they wanted to play. But you saw a different tactic from the head coach. He came to attack. He came to punch first. He didn't worry about the defensive end. He punched. He came to give them the first punch. And then for them to answer the first punch, And then they have taken advantage of that. Instead of I had one come give the first punch by knowing their weakness. But I was reminded the head coach is a very experimented coach.
Absolutely. So Al Ahly beats AS Douan. Who were the key players for Al Ahly to get the job done?
Of course, everybody knows who was the key player. Who was the key player for them, you know? You know, the winner of Hakim Olajuwon Trophy, and he was a key player. But you can see that for everybody play. I'm going to tell you one thing about the northern part of the country being really good. Look, they are financially stable. They are able to bring consistency. They're able to make the player comfortable for everything they need to do.
Right.
And all these teams, and they have that capability to do and consistently. They can bring good players and they stick together. And they have the financial means to really put the team together ahead of time and prepare for this league and more of the time. And if you see a lot of teams in Africa, they put the team together really late. You know, and we see it's Bera, one of the coach's one player who joined them 2 weeks before.
I couldn't agree with you more. Lastly, if we can quickly touch on that Stade Malien versus Petro de Luanda game. Stade Malien, a debutant team, was able to get a victory and give Petro de Luanda their second loss of the tournament back-to-back after not losing anything from the conference. What did Stade Malien have to do in order to get the job done against the Angolan Giants?
That Stade Malien always comes strong when they get beat by any team. That Stade Malien team came strong when they get lost on a team. If you beat them the next game, whoever they get, they beat them by 20. And that's the competitiveness. And we saw that they had a lack of experience in this late minute. That's why they lost Al Ahly on that team.
But Sheikh, lastly, what was the environment like in Kigali? And do you see that, you know, that the country is really taking this basketball game very seriously?
This month become a very sportsmanship month for Kigali. And this month of the year, like everybody come here, Mokbil. You see, we saw a lot of celebrity, American celebrity, NBA stars. You know, you just mentioned the president. It was so many icons, African icon players. We saw a lot of in Mahini. You know, a lot of people that have the mentality to give up to Basketball Africa League move. It's a moment that, like we call it, the one that using sports as a soft power to get what they want. Majority of them, we saw Masai. Who's going to be here in a little bit for Giants. Final game, the president came in, even though the home team was not playing. That really showed that he's supporting of these things 100%.
Amazing, Sheikh. I'm so glad you guys had a great experience over there. Great reporting from Kigali throughout the entire playoff tournament. Thanks for being with us today, Sheikh.
Thank you, Mugbil.
And lastly, U.S. President Joe Biden today slammed Uganda's harsh new law against homosexuality as a grave human rights violation and threatened to cut aid and investment in the East African country. He called for the immediate repeal of the tough new measures, which state, among other things, that engaging in acts of homosexuality could be punishable with life imprisonment. Biden's statement came a few hours after Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni signed the measure into law. The European Union and international rights groups also have condemned it. Ugandan lawmakers have said they followed the wishes of the country's voters in passing the law. And many Ugandan officials decry what they call foreign interference in the country's affairs. The United Nations says the protection of members of the LGBTQ community is a basic human rights. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.